Turn my camera on and screen share my iPad, I think is what I got to do here. I can remember how to do that. Screen share. Start. And I think that's going to do it. We'll be up and running. Although my screen's not reflecting that. Why is my screen not reflecting that? Something's not working right. Okay, one more time. Oh, I think I need to stop here. And then technical difficulties. There we go. Okay, we are back in session. What is it, Monday, April 20-something, 27th. And how's everybody doing? Okay, how many people do we have? 17 minus two, because I'm logged in twice. I think it's where we're at. Hello, Eric. Hello, everyone. Lene is here.
Did you recently have a birthday?
I did recently have a birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Yeah.
Sorry we didn't get to hold you a party.
Ah, I'm so bummed. Ah, tradition's broken.
Sorry. I dropped the ball. We could have done like a Zoom call or something.
No, that would have been fun, but silly. Yeah, it's odd too with Zerub and I trading sections, because usually by this point, I've had the class for a semester and we're getting close to the end of the second semester. And so the birthday celebration that has been traditional has always been in my mind, sort of this celebration of a class. And it's always fun and I enjoy it and I love it. And it's unique because no other instructor seems to get this kind of love, but.
It's true. Yeah. I've never had this with any other instructor.
No, I know. It's different. But that's why I try not to take it personally and say this is about me. It's more about the class and the class gelling together.
Yeah.
And having some reason to come together and to celebrate sort of the end of the semester, and we always make a day of it. It's always kind of fun, so I always love it, but I always think it's more about the class. So anyway, yes, I am now officially an old geezer. It's what happens to Portuguese people when they get old. They become Portuguesers, and that's officially where I'm at, I think. So, okay, enough about that. We're recording. All that's on recording. That's fun. You always gotta be careful when you're recording everything. So where we left off on SN1 reactions. And the SN1 reactions, so if you're looking at the screen and we're screen sharing, and I think you guys can see everything, we left off on the substitution nucleophilic first order. And let's see, I've got a pointer in here, so I can use the pointer, maybe. And we did the R leaving group going to form a carbocation, and then that reacts with the nucleophile, and we make the R nucleophile plus the leaving group. And so this is a stepwise reaction where we start off when we first go to a high energy state where we have this carbocation that we're going to talk a lot about. And then a second step, which is fast, which is the nucleophilic attack step. And we've said that we're going to come back today and we're going to use Hammond postulate to talk about the shape, the geometry, and the characterization of this transition state and how it's related to the leaving, to the substrate itself and the carbocation. So the rate of that reaction we said was equal to K times just the concentration of our leaving group, that the nucleophile does not appear in this rate constant. And we had several examples that we showed. And at the end of that, we said that all of these were tertiary substrates. So we had a tertiary alkyl halide, a tertiary chloride, tertiary tosylate, tertiary hydroxyl group, and that all of these are going through the substitution reaction to their corresponding products. And we talked about what the shape of that tosylate was. And That was something I was going to do today, eventually going into some of these other leaving groups and the shapes of leaving groups and why leaving groups are important. So that'll come into play today a little bit. But we'll start now a new page and start off with these SN1 reactions, which by and large are called sovalesis reactions. So that's kind of where we'll start. Sovalesis is a type of reaction which means replacement by solvent. So these are sovalesis. And replacement of leaving group by solvent. SN1 reactions are often characterized as sovalesis. It's possible to have an SN1 that is not sovalesis, but by and large, most of the SN1 reactions are sovalesis reactions. And so what we have is we have some substrate and we have the dissociation of the leaving group forming a carbocation. So I'm just going to write some things down under here as we go through each one of these steps. So this is dissociation and carbocation formation. And this is unimolecular. When this guy pops off, what it leaves behind is the carbocation. The chloride comes off and is the leaving group. And then we have some other solvent molecule, generally that is neutral, that comes in and does the nucleophilic attack. Let's do that in red. And then that step is really pretty fast. Leading towards the formation of the product, which at this point is usually protonated. And so we have a proton transfer step. And it is oftentimes the leaving group or something in solution which takes and does that proton transfer step. So this is the proton transfer. Leading towards the final product. So that leaves the alkyl group there and we get HCl as the byproduct out of this. So we have two fast steps and then we have a slow step, which is the rate determining step. So the slow step is the dissociation and the formation of the carbocation. That is really the slow step. So when we look at this mechanistically in an energy diagram, and I'm going to try to keep everything on the page here at the same time, it's hard because I want to write down towards the bottom, but the more I try to write down towards the bottom, it is much harder for me to draw down there. And yet I want to keep the stuff on the top of the page. So when we have an energy diagram, what we have is this substrate that is going through the unimolecular dissociation. And as it does so, it produces the high energy carbocation. And the carbocation sitting up here with the solvent also in place and the leaving group, all of this is present at this energy state. So that's all there. And that has a very high activation energy for its formation. And the transition state there is related to the shape of the carbocation. Then we go through a fairly fast step where we get nucleophilic attack. We come down to a fairly low energy state. where this is protonated and the chloride ion is here. So we'll do that nucleophilic attack, and then we'll take the proton, giving the electrons back here. And this step, I draw this way because I'm picking up the HCl, but there's a piece that I don't like about this step very much. And that is that I'm going up in energy slightly, and I need to make some adjustments in my energy diagram because something didn't quite work out the way I wanted. This is the advantage of being digital, that I can clean things up when I make mistakes. Okay, and so this has a small activation energy here as well, and a little one here. All right, so there's our energy diagram. And what I don't like about this energy diagram, one of the things that that bothers me a little bit about this is that I come back up in energy after the nucleophilic attack step. And that's because it's higher in energy. HCl is a really strong acid. And because HCl is such a strong acid right here, stop rolling. This guy is such a strong acid that in generally it protonates everything. And so it's lower in energy to have the substrate protonated. It's lower in energy to be on this side right here before the chloride takes that proton back than to have the chlorine have the proton, which is why we don't generally run these reactions without having some other sort of sacrificial base. We have some sort of base that takes the proton so that the chloride ion doesn't have to take the proton back, which means that I actually come down in energy from this point in most times. But if I don't put that base in there, then I'm going back up in energy slightly when the HCl takes the proton back, which actually also means that most of these reactions don't run without some other sort of base, that they shut down because the buildup of acid pushes them back into reverse and the reaction actually sort of shuts down. So you need that sacrificial base in there in order to have these reactions go forward in a sense. Okay, so we've got the energy diagram that's there, but what we really want to do is we really want to focus on this rate determining step. And this point here is what's going to lead us to understand the chemical reaction more. And we've also talked about that in terms of Hammond postulate, that in terms of Hammond postulate, that the transition state is going to resemble the side that it most closely is in energy to. And that means that the transition state is most close in energy to the carbocation. So when we're looking at the rate determining step, the transition state of this rate determining step, that we're seeing that this guy, I took that a little too far, looks a lot like the carbocation. So I have a partial minus and a partial positive. And this is my transition state, and it's carbocation-like. Which means that to understand SN1 reactions, you have to understand carbocations. So that's where we sort of need to go next. We need to go next and look at carbocations and understand carbocations. Fortunately, everything that we've done to date supports understanding carbocations without doing a tremendous amount of extra work, so that we're going to rely heavily on everything that we've already known and understood. And I think you're going to be surprised that as we start to go through this, how intuitive some of this is because you've already learned it, which allows us to go a little bit faster, which is kind of interesting. So let's look at carbocation stability. As we look at carbocation stability, we can look at a methyl carbocation, which is just with the CH3 group. we can then use a substrate that has both primary, secondary, and tertiary positions, such that we can look at a primary carbocation versus a secondary carbocation versus a tertiary carbocation. And we can't get to a quaternary because, oops, I said quaternary. That's just that I'm writing tertiary. That didn't work so well. We can't get a quaternary carbocation because when you have four things connected to a carbon, the carbon has all its valence electrons and meets the octet rule, and so there's no positive charge. So we can have a methyl, we can have primary, methyl being sort of a unique case, different than primary. Methyl, primary, secondary, tertiary. And that we find that these are going in order of increasing stability. So this is most stable and least stable. And we would ask, well, why? Why is that true? Why is the stability increasing? And it comes to the concept of what is the nature of an alkyl group? Remember that alkyl groups are electron donating groups. So when we think about an electron donating group, an electron donating group is something that when I attach the electron donating group to something that has a positive charge on it, what it does is it feeds electron density into that. And in feeding electron density into that, the electron donating group takes on a partial positive, but it reduces down the hole to a partial positive. It dumps electron density into it and makes the positive charge less, thereby stabilizing the positive charge. So when I think about that, then what I can do is I can look at each one of these groups as having one electron donating group, feeding electron density into it. Let's see if I can do a little color change here to switch to, let's put the positive charges in first. So a secondary and a tertiary, and then we can switch to blue. So this is my electron donating group feeding in electron density. Now I have two electron donating groups feeding in electron density, and then finally down to three. And it becomes easy to see how a carbocation can be stabilized going from what was a primary carbocation to a secondary to a tertiary. And the amount of stabilization that is received by tertiary carbocation is just based on the number of electron donating groups that are around it. So what we haven't done is we haven't really said why the electron donating groups, why these alkyl groups are electron donating groups. And so that's something that's worth taking a second to figure out, is why is a, why is an alkyl group an electron donating group? We haven't really formalized that yet. And there's two sort of hypotheses that we can show, two reasons why this is true. One is called hyperconjugation. Hyperconjugation is a concept that is born out of localized bonding. Finn, there are methods, so the least stable, so they're more willing to donate. Methylation.
Sorry. My spell check.
Autocorrect. Yeah.
I meant methyl groups.
Yeah, the methyl groups are electron donating. Let's look at the reasons why they're electron donating, and then we'll see. But what we're saying is that the more alkyl groups there are, not methyl groups, but the more alkyl groups, the more stabilized the carbocation is. That's what we're saying. So it's not about methyls, but about alkyl groups in general. So it can be any chain length. Any chain length helps to stabilize a carbocation. And the hyperconjugation model is born out of valence bonding theory. So this is natural bonding theory. This is talking about localized orbitals or localized bonds. Here in the hyperconjugation concept, the image that we draw is one of having the carbocation with its empty p orbital, and the carbon that is adjacent to it is sp3 hybridized tetrahedral, and that sp3 hybridization allows for one of the hydrogens, but there's free rotation about this, so we have free rotation about the sigma bond. It allows for the orbital that is here to be the sigma bond, to dump electron density into the empty p orbital. It's sort of like a back donation. It is a donation of electron density residing in the sigma that dumps the electron density into the empty p orbital. And it's sort of a back bond or back bonding sort of process or idea. And that hyperconjugation helps to stabilize the empty p orbital. So if we think about the empty p orbital as being sort of the two different lobes, we have yellow and green being an empty orbital, and the sigma bond as being an orbital that is occupied, and it has those two little lobes generally here and here, that what we're doing is we're taking electron density that is present in that sigma bond and really backfeeding it into the empty p orbital, making sort of a almost a pi bond-like process there that helps to stabilize it. And the more R groups we have, the more alkyl groups we have around that carbocation, each one of them can back donate into that bond. And the more back donation we get, the more stabilized the empty p orbital becomes, basically reducing down the positive charge felt by the carbocation and spreading it around the molecule. It's delocalization, in a way, is what we're seeing there. So that delocalization helps to stabilize it. The other concept, of course, is molecular orbital theory. So we can look and say, well, what does molecular orbital theory say? And in molecular orbital theory, now what we're looking at is delocalized orbitals. These are molecular orbitals. So in terms of looking at molecular orbitals, here what we want to do is we want to say, right, within the molecular orbitals, we have the HOMO and we have the LUMO. And we've used these terms before. So here's our highest occupied molecular orbital and our LUMO. And the LUMO is the one that we want to focus on. This is the site of the carbocation. The carbocation is the LUMO orbital. That's how we view what that orbital looks like. And so when we take the same image of the carbocation, what we find is that the molecular orbital has a, well, I messed up what I wanted to do there, but let me reverse it. Let me look at two orbitals. And I'll highlight out what both of them look like. I'm going to push this up, copy it. Usually I do this in a different way and I kind of biffed it, but we're going to get the same information. Actually, we're going to get better information. So on the top, let's look at the LUMO. On the bottom, let's look at the HOMO, the highest occupied molecular orbital. In the LUMO, what I see is I see an orbital that is very large and centered over where the carbocation is. And it looks kind of like a pi bond, and it's an empty orbital, And so in being an empty orbital, it's going to be a yellow color and a green color. And that orbital extends out over the molecule and delocalizes and spreads out. And so it looks kind of like a pi bond and extends towards the alkyl group to some degree, with most of the electron density or absence of electron density centered over where that carbocation is. But in the other orbital, when I look at the highest occupied molecular orbital, what winds up happening here is that the orbital is sort of reversed. I have all this electron density, which is sitting, not squiggly, but roundish, is sitting here and extends and pushes over the carbocation. And so this is an occupied orbital. This has electron density above and below. And what this is doing is it's really using the orbital that is the highest occupied molecular orbital to feed electron density to the carbocation. And so it's literally doing the same thing as the hyperconjugation. It's literally feeding electron density towards the carbocation. This is showing delocalization, contribution to carbocation. And is delocalization in a sense. And so both these models, hyperconjugation and molecular orbital theory, show that electron density is being passed from the alkyl groups to the carbocation in an effort to stabilize the carbocation and delocalize the positive charge. By spreading it out, we make it more stable. That's the crux of everything. So Eric, could this form a double bond that is hydrogen, hydrogen leaves? The double bond idea, the concept idea of a double bond means that there would be restricted rotation, that we would see restricted rotation. And I don't think that we actually see quite restricted rotation around the carbocation, although we do see barriers to rotation that probably comes from the molecular orbital theory, and that the molecule is most stable when I have a sigma bond parallel to the carbocation, to the empty p orbital. So if you imagine the empty p orbital and where the empty p orbital sits, it's really this image that I want to grab. But if we take this image with us and we ask, is there a barrier to rotation about this? What we find is that when the orbital, got so much going on in this image now, I almost don't want to color it more. The empty p orbital, if I think about the axis of the empty p orbital, and I think about the axis of this carbon-hydrogen bond, that these two are lining up eclipsed in a Newman projection. Like if I could do a Newman projection and I could look down this bond and see what's going on Newman-wise, that what I would see is that I've got the carbon-hydrogen bond, which is here, and the empty p orbital, which is sitting behind it. So that's my p orbital. And I've got my sigma bond here, which is sitting in this area, which is backfeeding electron donation into that, that there is probably some restriction to rotation, that the donation is strongest when they are eclipsed. And the other alkyl groups are sitting out this direction because the carbocation is flat, trigonal planar. So that's another important aspect, is that when we look at a carbocation, our carbocation is not, sp3, it's sp2. Trigonal planar, bond angles of 120 degrees. So that's the other thing that we need to know about carbocations. So when we go back to Hammond and we look at this Hammond concept, that the energy of the transition state is linked to the carbocation, that what we're saying here is that my transition state and my carbocation, and this is our leaving group. That what's going on, actually, let's not put the activation energy in there, and let's give this a little bit more room. That what's going on in here is that anything that causes the carbocation to be less stable is going to increase my transition state energy, basically increasing the activation energy. And anything that is going to contribute to the carbocation being more stable is going to decrease that energy of that transition state, that they are linked together by Hammond postulate. That's really what we're stating here, is that those two are linked together. And so we can formalize that and we can say that the transition state energy is linked to the carbocation energy. And that the transition state is proportional to the carbocation stabilization. That's really what we're trying to say there. And so we can go through now and we can look at let me draw a couple different images for you. I was trying to give you a second to look at that last image before I just jumped on and moved on. Let's say that we have a substrate that has a primary leaving group on it. And that as this primary leaving group comes off, I'm going to get a primary carbocation. This sort of molecule, in order to undergo the unimolecular dissociation, going from this thing with the leaving group on it to my primary carbocation, is going to have a high activation energy, because this substrate is primary. And so when I look at a primary substrate, that's what I'm going to see. When I look at a secondary substrate, and the leaving group is in this position, so now we're secondary, what's going to happen is we're going to start off at about the same amount of energy, but we're going to come down to a more stable secondary carbocation. And so our activation energy is likewise going to be lower. And that when I go through and do that for a tertiary, and we take and make a tertiary leaving group, that I'll start off at about the same amount of energy, but I will come yet to even a lower energy for the tertiary carbocation. And that my activation energy is again even lower. And so remember that we're linking the activation energy to the rate of the chemical reaction, which means that in this sense, that a primary is going to be way faster than a secondary, which is going to be faster than a tertiary in the rate of the chemical reaction. So when we look at rate is going to be equal to K times the concentration of our leaving group. And it's only the geometry of that leaving group and whether it's primary, secondary, or tertiary that is really affecting things. And that the K is proportional to the activation energy for the chemical reaction, that K is equal to K naught times E to the minus delta G for the transition state divided by RT, and that that this is essentially K is equal to K naught times E to the minus activation energy divided by RT. And so, you know, delta G there delta G double dagger really is the activation energy for the chemical reaction. And so the rate of the chemical reaction is really proportional to the stability of the carbocation. That's where we go from. And we've shown the stability of the carbocation is primary, secondary, or tertiary, but that's not all the types of carbocations that we can have. Eric, so is this behavior like a pseudo hybrid of a sigma and pi bond? Yeah, it's hard to say. We're looking at two different models, and we can model this thing as much as we want. And the two different models can give us two different reasons of why we see alkyl groups stabilizing carbocations. We can view it from either model system, either the hyperconjugation or the molecular orbital theory. In essence, what we see is that an alkyl group donates to the carbocation and stabilizes the carbocation. But the better question is, well, what method was this? I mean, these are two methods that are induction, right? But we know that induction wasn't the strongest of the stabilizing factors. What other factors did we have when we were looking at acid base for delocalization? We had induction, but we also had size, and we had electronegativity, and then we had another big one, resonance. Yeah, Katrina, resonance. And so all those factors play into this as well. So all those factors of stabilization go directly back to stabilizing this carbocation and stabilizing molecules with charges. And that's what we need to kind of look at and understand as well, that this is not just about induction. It's also about resonance. So let's take an example and look at an example real quick. Let's take and ask which reaction is going to run faster. So let's give two reactions here. We'll put a chloride in this position, and we'll put a chloride in this position. So we have two different substrates reacting in methanol. So methanol is the nucleophile. We'll give each of them a little bit of heat, and we'll show the products such that, drawing that backwards. Ooh, not the eraser I wanted. Okay. There's the first product and the second product. Would be that product. And we'll call one reaction A and one reaction B. So we want to know which reaction is faster. Is it A or B? So what would we predict in terms of A or B? And we can go through and we can classify that in A looks like it's a secondary substrate. So we're hitting the location where that alkyl halide is attached. The other one is a tertiary substrate. That's where that one's attached. And so which one of these should go faster, A or B?
A.
A. Hey, wait a minute. A is secondary.
Wouldn't it be B?
Well, B is tertiary. We don't know. Okay, so differences of opinion. Some people are saying A, some people are saying B. And it depends on what you're looking at. So if you're looking at secondary versus tertiary, well, we would say maybe B should go faster. If we're looking at the overall structure and what's actually happening, let's take each mechanism and break each mechanism down and look at what actually happens. So let's look at the carbocation that results from each, because that's what actually has to happen. You can't just look at the reaction and look at the substrate. So number one, don't look at the substrate, look at the carbocation. So we'll look at the resulting carbocation. All right, so for the first one, again, I'll shrink it down, keep them on the page a little bit. For the first one, what we have is when the chloride comes off, it results in a secondary carbocation. But that secondary carbocation is not just secondary, it's secondary allylic. And because it's secondary allylic, it has some resonance associated with it. And we know that resonance helps to stabilize the activation energy, or stabilize the stability of the carbocation itself. This is a very stable carbocation. And so what this does is, this is a more stable C plus that lowers the E sub A for formation. If we take and we look at the other substrate, what we find is that when this chloride comes off, what we get, let's see, where does this go? I went to drew the bonds the wrong way. Let's try one more time. We'll draw it backwards. There we go. That we get the tertiary carbocation and no resonance. So essentially, what we're seeing is that the reaction that had the more stable carbocation, this reaction here, is going to be faster. And that's due to the allylic nature, the resonance that's in here. So this one is going to be the faster chemical reaction due to resonance. That it's actually the carbocation that's most important in determining which structure is going to undergo the chemical reaction faster, because it's about the activation energy. So if I draw the activation energies for each one of these chemical reactions, what we would see is that the activation energy for the first step and going to the carbocation, I need to do it a little bit smaller and closer. The activation energy for the tertiary C plus, and compare that to the activation energy for the resonance C plus. And that the activation energy is just smaller for the resonance C plus, which allows that chemical reaction to go forward faster. So that's what we're doing. So we can't just look at the substrate itself. We have to look at the resulting carbocation and figure out which carbocation is more stable. So let's try another example. Let's take another two substrates and we'll say which reaction is faster.
Hang on though.
Go for it.
Wouldn't the stability of the carbocation also affect the activation energy for the second part of the reaction?
Oh, okay, now you're gonna make me draw more. No. Let's get this out of the way for a second. That's a good question. That was Colin?
Yeah.
I was looking up. Yeah, good question, Colin. Let me draw both energy diagrams straight out then. Let's take
thank you
and look at the carbocation first for the resonance, followed by, let's assume that I come down and I protonate. Making me think how I want to draw this. I think this has to come down farther first because I'm going to have to take the proton back. We'll come back here to our final product. And we'll copy this energy diagram and paste it over here for our second reaction and get it kind of close in shape, except that this line needs to go away and all this needs to move up. So maybe not quite that far. Something like this. Okay, so in the substrate on the left, what I have is my leaving group. Which was the chloride. Is that what I had? Yeah, which is the chloride. So that comes off. That leaves me with the resonance stabilized carbocation. And then my alcohol, my methanol is going to come in and attack that. And it's going to come down here to this protonated state. And then the chloride ion is going to take that proton back. And we'll go to the product. So I end up there. My activation energy is here, and that really critical transition state for my rate determining step, which is linked by Hammond postulate, linking these two together. So the transition state is linked together. Let's actually try to point that towards transition state there. Those two are linked together so that the more stable the carbocation is, the more stable the activation energy. In the other sense, in the tertiary, when I look at the tertiary, what I've got is the chloride here. It comes off, and I go to the tertiary carbocation without resonance. Without any resonance there, that's higher in energy. And as that has come up in energy, that has taken this transition state energy with it. And so this guy is less stable in comparison to the one on the left. And that means that this is higher energy along with it. So how does that affect what's going on in the rest of the molecule or the rest of the area? So what is that, what's going on in this area? That really doesn't affect that or change that much. In terms of the incoming nucleophilic attack. The incoming nucleophilic attack is such a small step, has such a low energy, that it really doesn't affect it much. And so everything that's being affected is really the activation energy that is this energy here for the rate determining step. And it's really not doing much to change what's going on in the rest of the reaction mechanism. The rest of the reaction mechanism pretty much goes unhindered as it was. And I'm sorry, I'm not sure if I lost the thread of the question.
No, that makes sense. Okay. I guess I was just thinking, like, if the carbocation is less stable, then wouldn't it also bond or like be more
I get what you're asking. Okay, Colin, you're asking a great question. You're asking that if the carbocation is less stable, doesn't that mean that it will react faster in order to quench itself, in order to bind to the incoming nucleophile?
Exactly.
Yeah, and that the less stable a carbocation is, the more reactive it is. So it goes back to that mantra, and that's great, Colin. That's you're absolutely paying attention and being consistent with what we have said in the past, and that's a great thing. That when the nucleophile, when we have a carbocation that is unstable, our mantra has been, this is less stable, therefore more reactive, therefore is going to do whatever in terms of our acids and bases in the way that we talked about that before. So when we say something is less stable and therefore more reactive, yeah, in general, it's going to react faster, but it's going to react faster in its next step. It's going to react faster in the fast step anyway. So what we're concerned about is how long does it take to make the carbocation, because that's your rate determining step, that's your slow step. So if something is higher in energy, yeah, it can be more reactive, that's true, but how long does it take to get there, right? So if it takes a long time in order to get to that more reactive thing, the fact that it's more reactive and reacts fast once it gets there, yeah, that doesn't amount to much because it took us so much longer to get to it. But if I can get to a carbocation really fast, even if it's more stable and does its second step slower, slightly slower, at least I'm making a lot of that carbocation and it's going on to product really fast, the overall reaction will be faster. So remember that the reactions are in sequence of the rate determining step is the slowest step in the entire process. And it's that slow step that I'm worried about. And so it's the formation of the carbocation that I'm worried about, not how reactive the carbocation is once it's been formed.
Okay.
That was an excellent, excellent question and excellent detail.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay. So keep that in mind while we run another example here. So let's take this. We'll put some CF3 groups on it. And we'll put a chloride out here. And we'll do the same reaction with methanol. So we only have to focus on one thing at a time. Just focus on the substrate change. And let's take and put two CF3 groups here and the chloride there. And I'm going to take more time. Just draw my chlorides a little bit more reasonably. Okay, methanol and heat, and we get two products. One where the methanol attaches at that position, and one where the methanol attaches there. Okay, which reaction is faster? A or B? Don't allow me to distract you. I'm just filling in some more data here. What are we thinking? We're pondering. We know that Jason sets us up for failure all the time. We know that Jason is setting us up every time he does one of these. It always goes counter to what you think, but it doesn't go counter to the mechanism. What it does is it points out flaws in just rote memorization. It asks you to think beyond. Okay, so Eric, A, CF3 is electron withdrawing, which increases activation energy. So CF3 is an electron withdrawing group. CF3 is going to pull electron density out of a carbocation and make a carbocation less stable. So when we look at these carbocations, what we're looking at is two different carbocations. One, the carbocation in the first one, which has these CF3 groups on them. So these guys are electron withdrawing groups. So what we can do is we can highlight them as being red, and they are electron withdrawing groups, and they pull electron density away from the carbocation. So they're sucking electron density out of this. The second one, when we look at its structure, the carbocation for that one is going to look like this. So the carbocation is in the tertiary position, but now those electron withdrawing groups are directly attached. They're not offset at all. So they are sucking electron density out of the carbocation this way. So which one of these carbocations is going to be more stable? The secondary or the tertiary, A or B? Remember that electron withdrawing induction falls off with distance. A is going to be more stable. That's right. So A is more stable. Farther from the electron withdrawing groups. So if that is more stable, then by Hannon postulate, what that's going to do is this is going to have the lower activation energy for its formation, and it's going to be the faster reaction. So the one that's faster is A. Even though it's secondary, it's farther away from the electron withdrawing groups. So it's not that we can just blindly categorize these and look at them and see what is primary, what is secondary, what is tertiary. We have to go beyond that, and we have to look at what are the other factors within the molecule? Are there other electron withdrawing groups that are going to complicate this? Are there other electron donating groups that are going to complicate this, that are going to lend resonance to it? So we need to look for resonance. We need to look for induction. We need to look for all those factors that we've been paying attention to all along, and we need to keep that going and not lose sight of those. So it's not enough to categorize something as primary, secondary, or tertiary. We need to go beyond that and look at each step beyond that. Okay, let's look at another example. I know we would probably like to practice that. We're gonna get practice on that, I guarantee you, but we got a few more concepts that I wanna cover first. So let's take a new substrate and let's write out the product for this one. So this is an alcohol. This is going to go through a protonation step, HCl, where the chloride is going to be the incoming nucleophile. And if you had to draw the product for this, you would probably draw the product for this as going through the carbocation and the chloride attaching in this location. So what we would assume is that we would go through the protonation first. As we go through the protonation, we make a good leaving group out of the water molecule. That molecule pops off, takes me towards the carbocation, and then the chloride comes in and bonds to it, and I get that product. Okay, all's well and good, except there's another product that I also get. I get this product. And yields are 30%. And 70%. And the question is, well, where did that product come from? That's not where the leaving group was. How did that happen? So let's look at how that actually happens. When we have this substrate and we protonate it. Oh, I'm just so not able to draw. I'm going to draw closer up. We'll come back to the rest of the mechanism in a minute. When we have the alcohol and we protonate the alcohol, everything goes along as planned. We get the protonated leaving group. The leaving group comes off, leaves behind the carbocation. And this is where things get a little sketchy. There's a hydrogen that sits right here. That hydrogen, we've already talked about in a hyperconjugation model, is donating electron density to that carbocation. In donating that density to that carbocation, what we can think of is to think of it in this way. The carbocation is sitting here with its alkyl group, its hydrogen, and the empty p orbital. And adjacent to it is the carbon that that has the hydrogen in it, but it's got two alkyl groups on it. It's got the methyl group going back and the methyl group coming forward. And here in this guy is the sigma bond, which is feeding in some electron density into that orbital. Well, if it's feeding electron density into that orbital, part of the electrons that actually make up the hydrogen bond to the carbon are being fed into that empty p orbital. And if you just breathe on it the wrong way, it moves. It migrates. And it changes the location of the carbocation. This is called a 1-2 hydride shift. And I know I said if you breathe on it the wrong way, but that's not actually true. It's actually true that this 1-2 hydride shift is extraordinarily fast and leads to the main product, because it's dumping electron density into that empty orbital. And as it dumps the electron density in, it's kind of between states. It's kind of bound to both carbons at the same time. And it's going to shift to give whatever carbocation is more stable. And so we see these 1-2 hydride shifts. And then after we see the shift, then the chloride ion comes in and does its nucleophilic attack and leads us towards the product. And so the product is a changed framework based on the 1-2 hydride shift. So literally what's happening there is, if we take this image, we'll put it down here, that in between this image and the next image is the transition state for the shift. This is where the hydrogen is kind of bound to both locations at the same time. And so I have a partial positive that is spread throughout this. And the hydrogen is transferring as a hydride. So it's a partial minus, partial positive. We'll just put R group out there. That is the hydride actually shifting. And it's the transition state for the shift. And then once the shift is over, we go to a more stable carbocation, where now the carbocation is on the more substituted carbon. That's the hydride shift. And that's why the hydride shift is actually occurring.
Mind if I ask a question?
Please.
So how fast is this? So if you're conducting this reaction, would you get a racemic, after the nucleophilic attack, would you get a mixture of a primary, or of the secondary and the tertiary? Or would it all be tertiary?
You always get a mixture. So that's a great question too. You always get a mixture, but the major product is from the shift. The major product is once the hydride actually shifts. The hydride shifts are fairly fast. So it never goes 100% to that product, because what's happening is, in the process of shifting, as the leaving group comes off, the chloride is there and can sometimes attack before the shift actually occurs. So the splits that we're getting is, we're getting a 30-70 split, 30%, 70%. We're seeing a 30-70 split in these. The split depends upon the stability of the tertiary carbocation and the speed at which the shift can occur. It depends upon the concentration of the incoming nucleophile as well, to some degree. There's a number of factors, but generally what we see is that the major product comes from the shift, and so we always expect shifts in these products, and we start looking for shifts. So shifts are going to be, you know, there was a chapter where I said that from chapter 6, they go into carbocation rearrangements within chapter 6. And I said I wanted to look at carbocation rearrangements in context in chapter 7. This is where we pick it up in chapter 7. So chapter 6 has a lot of different shifts, but they don't tell you why it's shifting or why they're doing that. Generally what they do is when they want to understand a carbocation shift, they do a really cool reaction where they take some substrate that's got some sort of leaving group in it, like an alcohol, and then they hit it with acid. And the acid that they use is either magic acid or super acid. And these are actual acids. They're not just silly names. They're acids that are so strong that they make HCl look ridiculous. These are acids that protonate everything and tear apart everything. And their conjugate bases are ridiculously stabilized. They are ridiculously stabilized by a ton of oxygens and a ton of resonance. And so they don't want to bond anything. Their conjugate bases are super non-nucleophilic. And they use this in a solvent where the solvent can't attack the carbocation. And they let the carbocation form. And then they look at spectroscopically all the different carbocations that wind up forming from this and all the different carbon rearrangements. And then they can categorize how many of these they're seeing, you know, of each species, and they can figure out what the most stable thing is. And they do this with large molecules and allow the molecules just to completely tear themselves apart and rearrange. And there's stability studies that they're doing, and they use these different acids to do the stability studies. So that's kind of how these things are studied. But we can also, here's another thing, let's look at this. Let's take this molecule, very closely related to what we did before, and we'll treat it with H2SO4 and water, and we'll give it some heat. Water's our nucleophile, and we've got heat incoming. I wind up getting two products out of this. I wind up getting my expected product, which is just getting the water coming back and attaching where I expected. But let's do this. Let's make this an O18. So it's a different isotope. And this is my O18 that is now bound to that. The other product that I wind up getting out of this is this one. And I get them in about a 40%, 60%. So the question is, well, how did that product come about? Because there was no hydrogen to shift. And presumably what happened, oh, you know what? I never went back. All right, we'll finish out this example and then I'll go back and I got to do one more thing. So what happens here, it was just a piece of information I wanted to give you guys and I forgot, but we'll get there. What happens here is the protonation first. Followed by the loss in the leaving group. And the carbocation formation. But now what's happening is that any sigma bond can be used to stabilize the carbocation. And so if I think about the different sigma bonds that are here, there are hydrogens that are here. And I have these sigma bonds, so we can sort of look at these bonds here as being possible bonds that could migrate. So those are sigma bonds. The other place where I have sigma bonds are here to the CH3 groups. And in order for a shift to occur, you have to go to lower energy for a shift to occur. You cannot go to a new molecule with equivalent energy. So in other words, I was at a secondary carbocation here. If I move one of the hydrogens, I go to another secondary carbocation. So let me move the secondary and put it next to where the carbocation is. And let's say by 1,2-hydride, I could go to this substrate here where the hydrogen is now here, my other hydrogen is still here, and I shift the carbocation. But this is also a secondary carbocation. And so because that's a secondary carbocation, this doesn't occur. Equal in energy. So we don't see that. What we do see is that one of the alkyl groups can migrate. And as the alkyl group migrates, now I get a tertiary carbocation. That's more stable. And so what I see is the tertiary alkyl group migrate, and then the incoming water, which is the O18, because I did it that ridiculous way. This comes in and binds to that carbocation, and then we go forward from there, making the product. And there would have to be a deprotonation after this. Such that I would have a base, just my germinal base, take the proton, and then get to the product. And this is called a 1-2 alkyl shift. Usually just called a 1-2 methyl shift, but we're going to call it a 1-2 alkyl shift because not only methyl groups can migrate. Methyl groups do migrate because they're smaller than other alkyl groups. So the rate at which an alkyl group can migrate is dependent upon the size of the alkyl group. Smaller alkyl groups will migrate faster than larger. So usually what we see are methyl groups that that will migrate, but it's other alkyl groups that can migrate as two. And we're seeing them in a 1-2. It's always a 1-2 fashion. It's not a 1-3 or a 1-4 or a 1-5. It's always 1-2, 1-2, because it's about the back donation from the sigma bond into the carbocation that we tend to see the migration. That's what's happening. Eric, can a hydride shift occur equally or less to an equally or less substituted carbon? I think I answered that, Eric. We're only going to shift if we result in a more stable carbocation. If you shift and you get an equally stable carbocation, then no shift occurs. So Finn, what's your question? Orthos, I don't understand.
No, they're all ortho groups.
Ortho is on a six-membered ring system. And in a benzene ring, when we have two groups together, X and Y, this is said to be the ortho position. That's only used on a six-membered ring system. So if you mean adjacent in a 1-2 position, correct. But ortho is reserved for six-membered ring systems that are aromatic ring systems.
Got it.
Okay, cool. All right, the part that I forgot that I wanted to throw in here, I want to go back up to this guy. And what I wanted to do was, this is the important part that I wanted to hit in there, was the energy diagram. That when we start off on this, we go with a very high activation energy to the secondary carbocation. So we have our R leaving group and our rate determining step. So this is our activation energy for our rate determining step. That's the formation of the carbocation to begin with. From there is a small activation energy, and we go down to the tertiary carbocation. I apologize, my dog's just decided to get barky. And there is its own transition state for that. And then we go down to the product, and then up after deprotonation. And so it is always going down in energy to a more stable carbocation. We're never going to go up to a less stable carbocation, and we're never going to go to an equally stable carbocation. So we don't see 1,2 hydride shifts or 1,3 hydride or 1,2 alkyl shifts going to the same level carbocation. That just doesn't happen. And the other thing is, we only see one shift. It is very rare on the time scale of these reactions to see multiple shifts. So we don't see a hydride shift occurring 1, 2, 3 times in order to get to a more stable carbocation. For instance, let me show you an example. For instance, if I am doing a substrate and I have my leaving group here and I have 2 alkyl groups here, and I go through and I do heat and sulfolysis, so maybe I've got some H2SO4 to help with this leaving group, and this is in methanol, that what I'm going to get, let's make the leaving group an actual thing. Let's make it a bromide. That the product that I'm going to get is to have the methanol attached there. And we do not see, let's say, this is not observed. We only get this one. The reason there is that when I look at the carbocation formation, that the hydrides that are here could shift. But because they would be going to an equally stable secondary carbocation, I don't see the shift. So there's no shift observed. This doesn't happen. Secondary to secondary. If I shift again from that secondary, I would get a tertiary, and the tertiary would be more stable. But the problem is I don't get the first shift anyway, because it's equal in energy. And because there's equal energy, there's no emphasis for it to actually shift. So it's really important to understand that we get one shift. You get one shot at this shift. And if you can go to a more stable carbocation, great. If you can't, no shift occurs. The reaction just goes forward and you get direct substitution at whatever carbocation was formed. Is that making that clear? Just want to make sure that's clear. Okay, so I got 1 minute and I get to do something fun in 1 minute. So here's a substrate. And we're gonna do this with HBr. And some heat. And how many products? How many products can form out of this? Eric says 3.
I agree with Eric.
Is that Finn? Finn agrees with Eric?
Yeah.
I got 2 for 3. Anybody else? All right, so one way to look at this is to say, all right, where is my carbocation going to form? That's going to be my carbocation. And then how many beta bonds do I have? Essentially, this is the, or I guess alpha. How many alpha carbons do I have to this? So there's these alpha carbons, and then I have these alpha bonds that I could look at. And the alpha bonds would be labeled to be, let's throw in this hydrogen here too, that I have this bond, and this bond, and this one, and that one, that all those bonds could possibly migrate. So I could have an alkyl shift, and I could have hydride shifts. So I've highlighted all the bonds that could possibly move. And then what we need to do is we need to draw each one and see if each one gives us a more stable carbocation. So we go from the carbocation and then we look at, in turn, migrating each one of those bonds. And so we would take first and we would do the hydride shift. So this would be the hydride shift first off. And we say, all right, when we do the hydride shift, do I get a more stable carbocation? We started off at a secondary and this gives a tertiary. So that looks like that could give one of our products, right? I could then take the next bond and say, all right, what happens if I move the next bond? So now what I'm asking is, let's take this alkyl group that's here, not the hydrogen, but the alkyl group, and let's move that group. And if I move that group, then I end up with a substrate that has the alkyl group there and this. So we went from a secondary to a secondary. So is that likely to happen? No, that one's out. Okay, next one. I'm going to do the ring shifts after. Let's do these guys. So now I have this bond, and I could look at moving that bond. And if I migrate that group, and we would do it with an arrow like that. So I should be showing the arrows each time to show how the group is moving. Then what I get is that one. So this was a secondary to a tertiary. Is that a good one? Yeah, okay. And the second methyl group would be the same. So I don't need to explore both. I've explored one, I don't need to explore both. Now we have the unique concept of this shift. And what is that gonna look like? Holy crap, where is that going? All right, well, let's just redraw that exactly how it looks. And then we'll sort it out later. I need to draw this up slightly. That means that this bond is being reconnected there and that these two are now left alone. And that's where the carbocation is. That's where the other bond is. And that thing looks like a five-membered ring system with that and that. Started off as secondary. What sort of carbocation do I have? It's a tertiary, right? Is that a good shift? Remember that five and six membered rings are about equal in terms of their energy. That they're about the same amount of energy. While a four membered ring system has a lot more strain and a three has a lot more strain, oh, I'm so sorry about my dogs. So going from five to six or six to five works out just fine. Finley, God, stop. I'm at the end of class. It's the punchline. This is a good shift because I'm going to a ring system that is about as stable and it's carbocation. That's a tertiary carbocation. So that's a good shift. The other ring system, if I look at the other shift, and we were here, and there's the carbocation, and I want to look at this shift and moving that one in. That's going to take me to a five-membered ring system where I have out here a secondary and two groups. So this one went from secondary to secondary. So is that one likely to occur? No. So that one's out. So what I've got is it looks like I've got one, two, three, except when Colin and everybody else said three, what you also forgot was the original one. So there are actually four, exactly. So we get the original carbocation plus the three other carbocations. And so this comes out to four different products. We get the bromide attacking in the original position. We get the bromide attacking where we had the hydride shift to that position. We get the methyl shift and the bromide attacking in that position. And we also get the unique product with the ring shift that is the five-membered ring system with the bromide there and the alkyl group there. And the major out of all of these would really be the hydride shift, because the hydride shift is so much faster than an alkyl shift. So we always tend to go for the hydride shifts over the alkyl when they're giving equivalent carbocations. But this one was due to 1,2 hydride, and the other two were due to 1,2 alkyl shifts. Okay, so that's kind of where everything's going. And hydride shifts, alkyl shifts are a big part of the carbocation reorganizations and a lot of what we need to look at for our product. So it's not as simple as an SN1 or SN2 reaction. Within the SN2 reactions, there are no shifts. The SN2s are straightforward, and you need to be careful of the stereochemistry and such. But in the SN1 reactions, we have all of the hydride shifts and alkyl shifts that we need to watch for and look for the more stable carbocations. And that's going to take a lot of practice. So this is where OCHEM as a second language has great practice problems. I'm going to shoot you guys out a quiz to have you work on something that's going to give you some more practice in looking at carbocations. So I'll put something together to send out for that. And Linnea is also going to pull some problems out of OCHEM as a second language, and I maybe even be able to find some other worksheet things or something to send out for you. But it's practicing the carbocation shifts, hydride shifts, 1,2 alkyl shifts, only one shift, no more than one, and hydride shifts are faster than alkyl. Okay, that's the whole punchline. I went 10 minutes over. Oh, come on. I was trying to get that last punchline in. I didn't want to leave it without finishing out that last punchline. But hey, I'll stay on the line and entertain any sort of questions. And I'll stick around for a little bit. There's more to do on these, because remember that it's not just about primary, secondary versus tertiary. It's also the resonance. And so we can have shift to carbocations that will be a secondary, or even shifting from a tertiary to a secondary if the secondary has a lot more resonance in it. There's all kinds of things to show you guys yet and things to think about, but they are all things that we have done and that are sort of in your DNA already at this point. You just need to sort of trust in it, believe in it, and watch for it. Those are the main keys, and we'll show you what to look for. And yeah, lots more to come. So this is where it starts getting fun.
I have a quick question.
Go for it, Vin.
If we're given a problem, how can we tell whether it's an SN1 or SN2?
Ooh, you can't just yet. So right now, what I'm going to tell you is I'm going to tell you it's SN1 or SN2. After we go through the E1 and the E2s, then we come back and we do an entire chapter on how do you decide which mechanism is the appropriate mechanism. So for right now, I'm telling you. So you don't have to guess. Later on, I'm going to give you more information. And then we will use that information to try to decide whether it is SN1, SN2, E1, E2.
Got it.
Yeah, more to come on that though. Okay. So anyway, I'll stay on the line for a little bit. Let me know if you have questions. I'm here. And other than that, I'll be at office hours at 1:30 after I get a little lunch break here. And then we'll go to the afternoon lab. All right, so thank you guys for your attention. Thanks for a great class. And let me know if you've got any questions.
Jason?
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, Ian, go ahead.
So like what, I'm just a little bit, I just want to confirm that's how I'm reading it for the what, when you determine whether it's secondary or tertiary for the like the last example that you talked about.
Yes.
So you're looking at where the charge, right? Where the charge, the plus, is.
That's right. We're looking at where the positive charge is.
Okay, got it. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I'm doing secondary, you can still see the notes. So I'm gonna highlight it out sort of in blue because I already used red. That was my secondary position.
Mm-hmm.
And then where the positive charge is gone tertiary. Secondary to start with. Still secondary. Secondary to start with, now is in a tertiary position. So yes, we're absolutely looking at where the charge is located and correlating that with the substitution of the carbocation.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Finn, what was your question?
Does it always go lower in energy?
Or always goes lower in energy, never goes higher.
Okay, so you won't start with the tertiary and go to a secondary?
I might start with the tertiary and go to a secondary if the secondary is stabilized by a lot of resonance. So yes, there's possibility of going from tertiary to secondary only when the secondary is more stable than the tertiary. So in answer to your first question, will it always go lower in energy? The answer is yes. In answer to the second question, will it ever go from secondary to tertiary, from tertiary to secondary, only if it's lower in energy?
Can I see an example of that?
Sure. So let's say that what I've got is I've got a tertiary leaving group. Let's make this one a bromide. And then along with this, I've got, let's put an oxygen here, a methoxy group that's there, or maybe even two methoxy groups. That's even better. What I'm doing is I'm doing this in methanol. And we'll just throw in a little bit of heat. As the bromide comes off, the substrate goes first to a tertiary. Maybe I only want one of these for right now. That makes it a little bit easier to see what I'm trying to do. This is a tertiary carbocation, but I have two hydrogens that are sitting there that can shift, that can migrate. When they migrate, or when one migrates, it leaves me with a secondary carbocation. So now that hydrogen is sitting over here. So I started off with tertiary. Now I'm at secondary. But the thing about the secondary is that it's got resonance from the oxygen. And that it's got major resonance from that oxygen. So this is a resonance contributor that is major. And because of that, it's way more stable than the tertiary carbocation. So now the incoming methanol can attack at this position. Let's do the arrow a little bit carefully. And we're not at the final product yet. We'd have to deprotonate to go to the final product. But this is an example. Now the base takes the proton of where a shift would occur due to the greater stability provided by resonance. So resonance is a hugely stabilizing factor. And what we're seeing is that this resonance makes the secondary carbocation more stable than the tertiary. So yes, I can shift from secondary to tertiary as long as the tertiary is more stable. It's always governed by the stability. We are always going to a more stable product, never to a less stable product. So secondary versus tertiary is not the whole story. It's also what else is attached to it, and what is making it more stable or less stable. Does that help, Finn?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome, for sure. Okay. You guys ready to call it? Ying, do you have any other questions?
Question. So when you're drawing the the curve arrow, so is there a specific place where you should be placing it? Whether you should attack in the back or on the side of the compound?
No, when I do the arrow and I'm migrating a group, let's say that I just have some substrate and I have the carbocation there. and the hydride, I'm moving the arrow. The arrow is literally going to the carbon of the carbocation. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I get a little bit sloppy in the way that I move that arrow, but it's always going to the carbocation location, whether it's an alkyl group that's migrating or a hydride that's migrating, such that if I have even like a five-membered ring system with a secondary carbocation group out here, and the hydride that is migrating, I want to migrate not the hydride, so I'm going to leave an alkyl group there. I'm going to leave this as a methyl group. And the bond that I want to look at that I'm going to migrate is this bond. In migrating it, I draw from the bond to the carbocation. So it's always from the middle of the bond that you're migrating to the carbon of the carbocation that you're migrating to. And this would result in a structure that is now going to have a six-membered ring system. And the methyl and the ethyl and the carbocation results at that position. So let me number these really quickly for you. So this would be numbered out. 1, 2, 3 is the carbocation. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, 8. And as we come out 8, 8 got reattached to 3.
Mm-hmm.
So 8 got reattached to 3, 8 to now 3. And, I see what I blew. I knew I was doing something wrong. I couldn't find it. Nope, that's not right. 4 should have my...
Four should have
this. Uh-huh. And the positive charge should be on 4. Okay. Now we're better.
Okay.
So that's where numbering comes in really handy, because even... Like I said, I keep trying to tell you guys, even though I've been doing this for years, I'm still prone to making mistakes when I'm just doing a quick draw. So taking the time to number it and making sure that your numbers match is always important.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Anything else, Finn?
So if you have a secondary carbocation that has residence, but then you also have a tertiary carbocation that that can shift, which one would you be able to tell is more stable?
If the tertiary doesn't have any resonance, then I would say the secondary would be more stable, because what we're doing is we're still using those principles that we said that it was electronegativity, hybridization, then resonance, then size, then induction. And that this was our most important. And we rationalized these by looking at the pKa values, that we said that the pKa difference that these made, that that the electronegativity hybridization can be, 60 on down to 30, 35. So this can be about a 20 to 30 pKa difference in terms of stability. That resonance made a difference that was on the order of 10 to 15. Size was like 5 to 10. And induction was on the order of like a couple of tenths on up to maybe 1 pKa unit. And so we use those pKa units to rationalize stability. And so you can think about those in the same sort of way, dealing with carbocations and shifting carbocations, that resonance is one of the biggest factors that we've got. Yes, electronegativity, hybridization, but because we're looking at carbocation shifts and shifting from carbocation to carbocation, that the bigger issue is going to be one of resonance than of hybridization or electronegativity, because your electronegativity and resonance cannot change for carbocations because you're always on a carbon. You can't shift the carbocation to an oxygen or to a nitrogen. So resonance tends then to be our biggest factor. and that's what we want to pay attention to.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I think that's it.
Okay, cool. All right, I'll see you for lab this afternoon, Finn.
All right, later.
Okay, bye.